Chapter 4. Community. If your grandparents or great-grandparents lived in the United States, they almost certainly belonged to some sort of social organization. Regardless of where they lived, what they did for a living, their race, their religion, or how recently they'd arrived in the United States, they were joiners, members of the long civic generation, born somewhere in the decades surrounding 1930. They belonged to churches and choirs, quilting guilds and farm boards. They were elks, black elks, moose, eagles, oddfellows, sons of Norway, sons of Italy, Mardi Gras crew members, daughters of the American Revolution, daughters of the Utah pioneers, Toastmasters, and Job's daughters. They joined the VFW, the Knights of Columbus, the Grange, the PEO, the American Association of University Women, the B'nai B'rith, the Junior League, the Luther League, and the Petroleum Club, and had long-standing appointments to play bridge and mahjong and euchre. And that's just a small smattering of the organizations that generation joined. The actual list feels as if it doesn't end, in part because the hunger for those sorts of groups felt limitless. They were secular and religious, ritualistic and informal, often delimited by age or race or gender or religion, and they composed the rhythms of your week. They were the way you met people, including love interests, especially when you moved to a new town. They were often a mix of social and philanthropic, opportunities to play cards, play dress-up, shoot the shit, get drunk, and or do good. Some of these organizations were incredibly exclusionary. Others propagated arcane ideas about race, class, gender, imperialism, and colonialism. You name it. The KKK, after all, was a social club with a racist agenda. Others provided a means of passing down language and ethnic traditions, or a space of refuge from the demands of living in white or male-dominated spaces. For W.E.B. Du Bois, for example, black societies provided a pastime from the monotony of work, a field for ambition and intrigue, a chance for parade, and insurance against misfortune. Whatever their purpose, these groups provided the literal and figurative infrastructure of the community. People joined them because it's what people did. They paid their literal and figurative dues, and then they were repaid with a structure where they could gather, a full social calendar, and peers to fill it with. They formed networks of loose ties, filled with people who aren't necessarily your best friends, but feel connected, and thus attentive to your well-being in some way. In many cases, these groups also functioned as official and unofficial mutual aid societies, with monthly dues that ensured that, in case of death, illness, or disability, your family would be provided for. No matter their ostensible purpose, these groups held yearly, monthly, and weekly fundraisers, parades, dances, and picnics. Many had educational and self-betterment programming, specific philanthropic arms, and offshoots specifically for children and young adults. They spiked in popularity early in the second decade of the 20th century, declined briefly over the course of the Depression, and then ballooned back to life in the 1950s and 60s. In urban neighborhoods, in the suburbs, in the smallest rural towns, some version of these social organizations existed, binding residents and their needs to one another. In 2000, the political scientist Robert Putnam published Bowling Alone, the first book to take a broad look at the rise of these groups and the results of their widespread decline over the course of the late 20th century. At that point, many of these organizations had spent the last two decades in denial, clinging to the belief that if they just sold their building downtown and built in the suburbs, if they just figured out how to recruit 30-year-olds, if they elected a new social chair, if they built a gym next to the church, the drop-off in membership could be reversed. But their surreptitious decline had little to do with the amenities or offerings of a particular organization. It was a symptom of an ongoing shift as the ideals of individualism began to eclipse the collectivism that had structured the post-war period. Collectivism is an overarching ethos of we're in this together, manifested in the tax code, the way we think of the social safety net, even the way we conceive of our responsibility to people we don't know. In The Upswing, his follow-up to Bowling Alone, Putnam frames the rise in collectivism, particularly in the early 20th century, as a means of seeking social solidarity amid a time of profound technological and societal change. These groups provided asylum from the disordered and uncertain world, a sort of second comforting home, while their mutual aid components provided reassurance that catastrophe would not pull an individual family asunder. In the second decade of the 20th century, the collectivist ethos began to manifest itself in progressive policymaking, which would continue in various waves throughout the 1960s, and, at least for white people, transfer the mutual aid component of these organizations onto the state. The most famous of these reforms fell under the umbrella of Franklin Delano Roosevelt's New Deal, but they also included programs that worked to universalize and extend education at all levels, to decrease infant mortality rates and increase life expectancy, to fortify labor protections, and, via the tax code, to equalize the distribution of wealth. The Tennessee Valley Authority, a public utility program that worked to electrify and modernize one of the most impoverished areas of the United States, is a collectivist mindset initiative. So is Head Start, which was founded in 1965 to provide early childhood education and health services to low-income families. The overarching mission of these programs was not just, we have a moral duty to help the poor. It was, again, that we are only as strong and resilient as our weakest member. The problem, of course, was that these programs were compromised by endemic racism. We're all in this together, but black and brown people are in it together over there, and women are expected to reconcile themselves to secondary citizenship. The civil rights movement, the women's movement, and the United Farm Workers movement were all, in some way, attempts to create laws and labor protections that would spread the benefits of collectivism and American citizenship more equally. Yet these movements' incremental successes coincided with pauses, cuts, and reversals to many collectivist gains. As Putnam points out, educational gains began to pause right around 1965. Membership in unions, which helped buoy the incomes of millions of Americans above a living wage, had already started its long decline in 1958. Tax cuts in the mid-1960s made it easier for the rich to stay and get richer. And waves of deregulation began to turn the purpose of previously public-oriented institutions over to the whims of the free market. Some of these shifts were responses to the growing panic over the threat of global competition, but they were also implicit and explicit responses to the expansion of who was now benefiting from the collectivist ethos. The message? We'll let everyone into our "we're all in this together" party, but then we're going to turn the lights off, and it's every person for themselves. That individualist approach, the overwhelming focus on me and mine, started to take root in the 1970s and gradually became the dominant political and ideological posture of the last 40 years. Individualism cloaks itself in the rhetoric of self-reliance and stoicism, and is often a response to economic instability, the loss of professional identity, and the overwhelming desire to create a better life for your children. It can manifest skepticism towards government spending or a deep resentment for any tax dollar not spent to your family's direct benefit. It's a core tenet of both libertarianism and neoliberalism. And the corresponding inclination, in the economist Norina Hertz's words, to see ourselves as competitors, not collaborators, consumers, not citizens, hoarders, not sharers, takers, not givers, hustlers, not helpers, people who are not only too busy to be there for our neighbors, but don't even know our neighbors' names. People who've adopted an individualist attitude aren't necessarily sociopaths or assholes. They'll still donate to a GoFundMe to help a local kid with cancer, or even stop to help someone on the side of the road if they look safe. They chip into the gift fund for a coworker's 50th birthday, tithe to their church, and fundraise for their children's school. They do want to help others, but they want it to be on their own terms and arbitrate who's worthy of receiving it. They are often obsessed with the idea of fairness, that one can benefit from something only in so much as they've contributed to it themselves. Crucially, people who might politically embrace a collectivist ethos, like nationalized health care or mandatory parental leave, can still make deeply individualist decisions, especially when it comes to their perceived ideas of safety, good schools, and doing what's right for our family. Individualism creates and deepens inequities. It mires us in endless arguments about worth and deserving, and creates so much unnecessary suffering, alienation, and resentment. It forces us to obsess over the need to prove our value. Instead of wondering why the perch where we find ourselves is so precarious, we obsess with how to best keep ourselves steadied upon it. It's a root cause of so many of our worst tendencies and afflictions, in and outside the office. The cult of productivity, widespread burnout and anxiety, sustained exhaustion, obsession with cultivating our children as mini resumes for future success, lack of personal or community identity, and profound loneliness and alienation. People say that we, as a society, worship consumerism, that we have made false idols out of things. But that pronouncement increasingly rings false, particularly for office and knowledge workers. We worship work. We remain faithful to it because we want to support ourselves and our families, but it's become more than a simple means of providing needs. Work has taken on such a place of primacy in our lives that it has subsumed our identities, diluted our friendships, and disconnected us from our communities. Individualism induces work obsession, and that work obsession, in turn, keeps us mired in individualism. We have turned inward, toward our immediate families and our jobs, at the expense of all else, a process that has been facilitated by the digital technologies that allow us to not only work more, but simulate the experience of actual connection with others. We've forgotten how to care for each other outside the bounds of family, or gather with each other outside the compulsion of our jobs or our children's activity schedules. We have lost or are barely clinging to our support systems. Our reliance on individualism has left us where it was always going to leave us, incredibly alone. This devolution has been happening for years. We've just distracted ourselves from it with a quick vacation to convince yourself you were living a balanced life. But the pandemic has clarified just how untenable the situation had become. We need each other. We crave connection. And as we poured ourselves into work and productivity, its returns, particularly on the deep, soul-nurturing level, only continued to diminish. There has to be something more. So what's the answer? Do we all just start going to religious services again? Find a nearby Toastmasters chapter? Pick a hobby, any hobby, buy some gear, and go for it? Our best selves can aim to do so, but if work maintains the same place in our identities and worlds, it's simply not going to happen. You'll Google info on a group and forget about it. Donate some money and step away. Make plans to attend a meeting and cancel. Most people will look at the list of organizations at the beginning of this chapter and think, who has the time? But that's the thing. You could. Not by jam-packing your schedule to the point of breaking or forcing all household duties onto your partner. By using the time freed up by a flexible, guardrail-enforced schedule and filling it with things that nourish you and working toward the sort of collectivist change we crave and need. Because this detailed, diligent labor to liberate ourselves from our addiction to work will be meaningless if its benefits extend only to people who work and live and look like us. You might feel powerless or nihilistic about our potential as a society, convinced we will never be able to actually embrace collectivism again. But, as Putnam argues, there is convincing evidence that we are at the beginning of an upswing in collectivist sentiment, because the promises of individualism have proven so thoroughly unsavory for all but the most rarefied elite. Now, after a year of massive societal turmoil, is the time to embrace new and difficult solutions, ones that more equitably distribute risk and stability, that refuse to neglect the race and gender-based inequalities that undercut the last collectivist swing, and that continue to underline our need and strengthen each other, before we simply reconcile ourselves to the status quo. There is such tremendous promise to a potential shift to hybrid remote work. But there are great risks, too, particularly when it comes to the health of institutions that form the ever-fragile foundation of our communities. Because no significant societal change, especially one with the potential to alter the daily movements and habits of up to 40% of a nation's workers, happens in a vacuum. What follows aren't intended to be detailed policy solutions. You could literally write a book on each of these areas, and there are people who are in the process of doing that work right now. But as we move forward in our thinking about the future of work and its place in a more collectivist society, there are so many areas that will demand attention, assistance, and protection. Here are some initial but by no means exhaustive ideas for where to focus. The post-pandemic city. In May 2020, the CDC made a recommendation to employers. If you can, encourage your employees to stay away from public transportation. Instead, they should attempt to take personal cars or rely on cabs or ride shares. For Sarah Jensen Carr, an assistant professor of architecture at Northeastern University and the author of the forthcoming book, The Topography of Wellness: How Health and Disease Shaped the American Landscape, that guidance was part of a host of pandemic-induced decisions, many made with the very best intentions, whose ramifications cities will have to grapple with for years to come. There have been very few documented cases of disease transmission on public transit, Carr told us in December 2020. But the actual epidemiology doesn't matter. It's the narrative, what's embedded in people's minds. So when you have the CDC telling people that they should take their own vehicles to work, it rolls back so many of the positive transit developments that have happened over the last 20 years. New car sales actually plummeted during the pandemic, reaching their lowest point since 2012, but they've rebounded in 2021, and used car sales have skyrocketed. This is particularly true of people in urban areas who'd eschewed cars for years. Suddenly, a car felt like the only safe way to get anywhere outside walking distance, or actually out of town to visit parents or grandparents. For those who could afford it, a car felt like a solution to a problem of pandemic-enforced immobility. But those cars haven't disappeared, and neither have the newfound habits around them. Whether because of increased remote work, increased reliance on personal vehicles, general reluctance to be in proximity to other people, or moves out of the city, the overall demand for public transit has gone down. But that does not change the necessity for that transit. Even if ridership decreases 25%, there are still, depending on the size of your city, thousands, tens of thousands, even millions of residents who rely on it. Public transit is the circulatory system of a city. When it languishes, so too does the quality of life within the areas it serves. If we want healthy cities, we have to figure out ways to treat it not as a perk or a convenience, but as a necessity, regardless of our personal usage. What does that take? Funding, for one. Otherwise, the financial situation that nearly every transit agency in America is in will certainly lead to significant service cuts, which inevitably lead to terrible spirals, Sarah Feinberg, the interim president of the New York City Transit Authority, said. Service reductions are bad for commuters, devastating for essential workers, and detrimental to the economy. If people leave New York and newcomers don't immediately take their place, that will reduce the city's subway and bus revenue, which will lead to service cuts. That will make New York a harder place to live, so more people will leave the city. Transit revenue will be reduced further, and on we go. A change in how and where we work will likely change what we want out of our cities and their transportation infrastructure. According to Ben Well and Sergio Avileda, who study public transit and urban mobility at the World Resources Institute, the solution involves rethinking revenue models, reducing reliance on fares, just to start, and increasing taxpayer funding. But it will also require fixing and expanding the infrastructure that's already in place, even if ridership has gone down. But just because we're not commuting 5 days a week doesn't mean we don't still need mobility. People working from home will still have to travel and go to meetings and live in their cities, Well told us. But he argues the traditional hub-and-spoke model of transit systems, one that in many American cities was designed using old streetcar lines, may need to be reimagined and supplemented by crosstown and connector bus routes and space allocation like dedicated bus and bike lanes. A change in working patterns and, by extension, commutes complicates this process. For many transit systems, ridership is the success metric for the health of the system, and often tied to funding. But if ridership is down, it could lead to more funding cuts and create a vicious downward spiral. To combat that, Wells said that the transit community is starting to look at different metrics besides ridership to gauge success. People are starting to ask, how well does the transit system provide access to opportunities like access to healthcare services or industry? How can it provide accessibility? Our current mobility system doesn't do a very good job of providing adequate access to this in most cities, but the pandemic may be a moment to reimagine what we want from these services, he said. A major theme running through this chapter is that taking bits of our concentration away from work and reapplying it elsewhere will better our communities. But there's a secondary reason to support a robust mobility infrastructure in a remote or hybrid working world: combating isolation. There's a common misperception that a world where we spend less time in offices means a world spent isolated in our homes. That's certainly a risk, but it's all but guaranteed if we don't adapt our cities to our way of life. And that means creating more opportunities in our cities to have amenities within close reach of people by way of walking, bicycling, or a short bus or subway ride. I imagine there's going to be a real acceleration in people wanting to have access to walkable urban neighborhoods, Well told us. If work is more flexible, our cities will need to be too. People will demand having quick access to parks or to private public spaces like lunch spots or coffee shops to do work and meet people and form community. We have to internalize that the more we fund these services, the more attractive and accessible we make them for all users, the healthier we and our cities will be. The same principle applies to public parks and green spaces, pools, community centers, public art projects. If the tax base declines because people have left the city, and you begin to neglect the very things that made the city special, even more people will leave, either by choice or by necessity, as the jobs that kept them otherwise tethered to a location disappear or go remote. It's a very slippery, very steep downward slope. That scenario has occupied Callie Williams-Yost, CEO of the Flex and Strategy Group, for the last year, as she's advised dozens of companies on their plans for a new, flexible workforce. Sure, you can do all this work to make your office feel safe and figure out guidelines for remote work, she says, but it's all going to go to hell if we take our eyes off how this overall shift could affect our cities. Instead of jamming this way of working on everyone, we should be stepping back and meeting with city planning officials, she said. Meeting with transportation people, meeting with politicians and public government organizations that address tax policy. We have to be working together to create a dynamic new vision of what the city is going to look like. Yost lives in one of the long string of towns on the New Jersey Transit line that, before the pandemic, funneled hundreds of thousands of workers elsewhere in the New York City metro area every day. In December 2020, the transit line sent out a survey asking workers about their current and projected transit usage. They're going to cut trains, Yost said. And then the train service will be even more horrible than it was before, and New York is going to try to claw back its own lost tax revenue by taxing us more on the way in, so it'll be even more expensive. If you have the option to go in one day a week or three, and the commute is a drag, and all the restaurants around your office building have closed up with no assistance to restart them, and the movie theaters are closed, and none of your friends are commuting in either, what's left to tether you to the city? It becomes this reinforcing downturn, Yost said, and no one's committed to figuring it out. It's just a total lack of imagination. If you own a corporate office, you need to be calling up the transit people and saying, we see the data, we are seeing the research, this is going to be a new reality. So we need to partner with you. How can we build a compelling vision of what's coming? Part of that vision will include workplaces. They just won't necessarily look like what we had before. There's so clearly still a need, Leslie Kern, a geographer who studies urban design and gender, told us. The pandemic showed us that. Cities and apartments aren't built to be everything to everyone, both spatially and socially. In the past, downtown business corridors didn't have many services nearby, in part because they've long been built to accommodate the point-to-point journeys of men in the workplace. But women's journeys, going back as far as the 1960s and 1970s, have always been much less linear. They're far more likely to drop off kids, do errands, and do elder care along the way. What would new city planning look like that actually accommodates a more varied understanding of the tasks and needs of all over the course of a day? Skyscrapers, for example, have been very single use, Kern told us. So how could we reimagine the skyscraper as a multi-use space? Clive Wilkinson, who designed Google's corporate campus and spends his days thinking about the future of office design, is energized by the sheer number of opportunities. He thinks companies and corporate real estate developers will likely reimagine their holdings as fluid spaces, with much more flexibility for hot desking and short-term rentals of collaborative space. He sees hotels adding adaptable, actually attractive co-working spaces in order to accommodate the influxes of remote and asynchronous workers, or companies straight up purchasing hotels for collaborative work gatherings and retreats. Wilkinson has spent his career reinventing office use, using big city planning as a primary inspiration. And while the office as city has been his long-running template, he foresees a reversal in coming years as metropolitan areas are redesigned around the idea of mobile, flexible work. Instead of the office as city, the city as office. But Wilkinson told us that businesses are especially flat-footed in the moment. Most of the clients we have, reps from and heads of real estate and facilities, are very confused, he said. It will take a few big companies to create a new paradigm and reframe the office as a highly communal social space that supports episodic work. There's so much potential, but I get the sense there's a fear and a certain laziness about it. Some of these big reimaginings are exciting. There's the 15-Minute City Project, a movement that advocates that everything a city dweller needs in life ought to be available within 15 minutes, without the use of a car or mass transit. But even small overhauls in other metropolitan areas show a viable path to a healthier city. During the pandemic, the mayor of Paris pushed the city to add 50 kilometers of bike lanes. According to some estimates, the amount of cyclists in the city has increased by more than 65% since the spring of 2020, and close to 15% of all transit trips in Paris are now made by bike. In Manhattan, the city government restricted traffic across town on 14th Street to buses and local deliveries. The results were immediate. Less congestion, more access for pedestrians, and bus travel times down between 15 and 25%. These kinds of small gains have urbanists imagining and designing a future where city streets are no longer dominated by tens of thousands of noisy, slow-moving individual cars. What might that look like? Well, according to Vishan Chakrabarty, a former New York City urban planning official and the founder of Practice for Architecture and Urbanism, it means more community spaces, luxurious sidewalks, and opportunities for vendors and commercial space, streetside dining, quicker commute times, lower pollution, and a transit system that is more accessible for underserved communities. It's a big ask. But if these sorts of collaborations and intentional designs fail to materialize, Yost's predictions for the future of cities, like those of many others we spoke to, are bleak, especially if suburbs do the imaginative collaborative work instead. In Westfield, New Jersey, a commuter suburb about an hour's train ride from Manhattan, the pandemic put the nail in the coffin of a sprawling Lord & Taylor department store that had been struggling for years. A nearly century-old picture palace, the Rialto Theater, had suddenly closed the year before. Over the course of the second decade of the 21st century, the downtown had clawed its way back from the recession and the competition of online commerce. Who knows how long it will take to revive this time? But the city council saw an opportunity to transform the empty department stores and parking lots into a space that would actually keep commuters local. It voted 8-1 to approve a redevelopment plan of 11 different downtown properties, plus the Rialto, and 7 parking lots. In their place, mixed-use development, including a 15% set aside for affordable housing, and the hope to attract businesses and foot traffic that might have otherwise gone into the city. The lesson? If urban centers don't make a concentrated effort to retain the qualities that made them magnetic, the more affluent tax base will be magnetized elsewhere. And elsewhere, as it turns out, is booming. As we write this, the pandemic's end is in sight, but still uncertain. One short-term trend seems clear. The pandemic's reorganization of people and resources has effectively supercharged mid-sized cities. According to data from LinkedIn, over the course of 2020, cities like Madison, Wisconsin, Richmond, Virginia, and Sacramento, California, saw the largest influx of tech workers. Some of these metropolitan areas and their suburban sprawls share similar characteristics. Many are college towns with lively downtowns populated with locally owned small businesses and restaurants. They have burgeoning or robust art scenes already in place. Real estate is cheap, at least compared with the country's biggest cities, but not too cheap, which generally means that these towns were often in the throes of an affordable housing crisis pre-pandemic. They're walkable, livable, still culturally rich areas near reliable airports, and they're eminently attractive to active, upwardly mobile, early or mid-career knowledge workers looking, at last, to put down some roots. Less than a year into the pandemic, the phenomenon had already earned these places a name: Zoom towns. Many Zoom towns, particularly those that function as gateway communities to outdoor areas in the West, have found themselves in a precarious position as the very attitude, vibe, and community that attract people to the area in droves are threatened by the influx of coastal salaries. Daniel Rumor, an assistant professor at the University of Utah, who studies urban planning challenges in these communities, argues that the influx of workers is creating small towns with big city problems. The gap between median wages and median housing costs just keeps getting wider and wider. In Bozeman, Montana, for example, the cost of living has soared to 20% higher than the national average, even though the median income for those employed in town is 20% lower. In February 2021, the average rent for a two-bedroom apartment was $2,050 a month, 58% more than a year before. As Heather Grenier, head of Bozeman's Human Resource Development Council, put it, "We have such low vacancy rates that if they lose a rental, there's literally no other place to go." According to Rumor, this type of natural amenity migration to places in proximity to nature and recreation, is a problatunity. It's important to highlight the downsides, but there are upsides too. Right now, Rumor says, the elected officials and leaders in many of these small communities are relying on anecdotal evidence and observations, which don't tell the entire story. That's why Rumor's team at the Gateway and Natural Amenity Region Initiative are trying to collect hard data on migration patterns and their effects, the sort that can help communities craft long-term plans for the future. Though it's still in its early days, the Gateway and Natural Amenity Region Initiative is trying to connect smaller Western towns, many of which have seen amenity migration expedited by 15 years because of COVID, with leaders in places like Jackson, Wyoming, Vail, Colorado, and Moab, Utah, all of which have spent decades dealing with their own influx of tourism, second home purchases, and permanent migration. Leaders in, say, Sandpoint, Idaho, don't have to go through these growing pains without guidance, the wisdom of experience, and which arguments will never really be settled. We hear communities endlessly debating whether this is good or bad for their community, and the hard truth is that when you're one of these towns, you don't get to make that decision, Rumor told us. This change will happen whether they like it or not, so instead, the conversation needs to be, how do you protect the things you hold dear? A big hurdle, Rumor admits, is that many of these desirable, rural Western communities are politically polarized, liberal enclaves in a sea of deep conservatism. The ideological split can make something as seemingly straightforward as a community meeting incredibly fraught. But residents of smaller gateway communities tend to share a love of place, its natural beauty, or its seclusion, or its history. When you frame discussions around what's worth preserving, it can bring people together, even if they disagree on the way to actually go about protecting the places and spaces they love. The questions towns need to be asking are, what tools and what techniques and resources do we need? And who do we want to be when we grow up? We have people who say we don't want to grow up, but you have to. You can't close the door behind you, Rumor said. If you adopt that mindset, you end up doing nothing, and it leads to uncontrolled growth. As with so many aspects of this book, the pandemic did not create the problems associated with mass natural amenity migration. But those problems have been neglected for so long that pandemic-induced acceleration pushed them to crisis level. And it's not that these cities, as governmental entities, don't want remote workers, per se. Many of them have struggled to cultivate industries outside the extractive economy or tourism for years, and crave the spending capacity and tax dollars that higher-income residents bring to town. Some mid-sized cities have been grappling with the constant drain of talent for years, coupled with the dawning reality that there is no new company that's coming to town, building a skyscraper and throwing thousands of jobs into the mix. Yet there is very little accounting for the ways that an influx of remote workers disrupts the quality and texture of other residents' lives. They can create a more fractured and volatile cultural, political, and economic environment, particularly when there's little guidance, funding, or past experience to draw on in order to handle new stresses. What's needed, then, is a system to assist, monitor, and mediate the transition, one that can protect the existing community while fostering sustainable growth. Tulsa, Oklahoma offers one template. Back in 2018, the city, with extensive support from the George Kaiser Family Foundation, embarked on a new experiment, offering remote workers a $10,000 incentive to move to Tulsa and take part in an intentional effort to build community. They can use the $10,000 reward toward a down payment on a house or for choice rates at an apartment building in the new revitalized downtown, with prices between $650 and $1,250 a month, and access to downtown co-working space. While the $10,000 figure put Tulsa Remote into the headlines, the most compelling part of the project is the infrastructure. The initiative has a full-time staff that not only selects the recipients of the stipend, but also helps integrate new residents into the community. Ben Stewart, the executive director of Tulsa Remote, told us that they struggle with cultivating the necessary balance. We take each applicant so seriously, he said, noting that the goal is to build what he referred to as an intentionally curated community. The program has had more than 50,000 applicants since its inception. In 2020, they welcomed 375 of them to the city. They try to select applicants who are dynamic and motivated and want to be members of the community. An ideal candidate is someone with a history of community service who is interested in new experiences. We are looking for people who want to add something, he said. Just coming here with a six-figure job working for Microsoft isn't really what we'd call a community alignment. Tulsa Remote says its goal is for its cohort to look like the rest of the United States, which means an intentional focus on geographic, ethnic, sexual orientation, and gender diversity. But they also understand that in order for the program to work, it needs continued nurturing. Each remote grant recipient becomes part of a mentor system, designed to both answer questions about the community and ease transition, but also address the potential problems or conflicts, sort of like the neighbor who can tell you the best place to get tacos, or what a Sooner is, or just what is the George Kaiser Family Foundation, and why is its name on so many projects in town. There's potential for a program like Tulsa Remote, which has been duplicated in Northwest Arkansas, Vermont, and Northwest Alabama, to help bridge the gap between a new set of residents and the more rooted community, especially as new citizens begin to get active in local politics. There's so much more access to power and decision makers in any smaller community, and you have the ability to impact and make change right away, Stewart told us. But you want to help foster the natural collaborations, which means finding those people who are the glue in one community and bringing them together with those who are the glue in another. In Obum Okabum's case, moving to Tulsa was a chance to make up for lost time. In 2015, Okabum nearly died from complications related to diabetes. Lying in a hospital bed in Los Angeles, battling sepsis, and unsure if he'd survive, he remembered thinking that not only was he not ready to die, but his life had been far more one-dimensional than he'd hoped. He'd been so focused on grinding through a grueling job that he had been unable to put down roots anywhere. He stopped volunteering, which had brought him great joy and purpose years ago. He spent large chunks of his day stuck in soul-crushing traffic, and often came home too tired to enjoy anything besides staying in. I look back at those days and see that, really, I was just trying to survive, he told us. And that wasn't just hurting me, it was taking away from others. How can you help people when you just need to help yourself? Then Okabum came across the Tulsa Remote Program. His friends, especially his wife's friends, were wary. It was all, how are you going to make friends? And be careful as a black man in Oklahoma, he recalled. But he was chosen in 2018 to be a member of Tulsa Remote's inaugural class, in part because of his desire to be an active member of the community and rediscover his passion for volunteering. Okabum looks back on his arrival in Tulsa and sees the emergence of a different version of himself. He immediately got in touch with local community theater, where he produced and co-authored 10 one-act plays centered on the massacre that decimated Tulsa's Black Wall Street in 1921. His wife rediscovered her love of cooking, launched a pop-up food truck, and now runs a permanent stall at the local food hall. Okabum joined CAP Tulsa, an early education community action program to fight poverty. He volunteered with organizations like Teach Not Punish, 100 Black Men, and Show Me Shoes, a young women's mentorship organization that he helped launch in town. He joined Leadership Tulsa, began volunteering with the Tulsa Debate League, and secured $40,000 investment for social and emotional learning programs in the city. After less than 2 years, he was named one of the three finalists for the Boomtown Award, honoring Tulsa's Citizen of the Year. Okabum moved to Tulsa for the remote program, but he ended up leaving his remote job to work with the Holberton School, a software development boot camp with a local campus. He's acutely aware that his story sounds like a fairy tale, and he remains a realist when it comes to the potential of the program. Moving to Tulsa wasn't necessarily easy, he says, even with the program's helpful infrastructure. He could sense people were initially apprehensive about outsiders, especially given the highly publicized $10,000 stipend program. He felt he had to prove himself and earn the trust of longtime residents. Even now, having been honored by the city, he understands the boundaries of his still new residency. He works hard to respect the city's history, including its tragedies and successes, and refuses to speak on behalf of the town's descendants, regardless of race. It was still hard work, in other words, to put down roots. But Okabum says that a program like Tulsa Remote can provide an on-ramp, and the sort of early support that felt essential. As he sees it, the $10,000 stipend gets all the headlines, but the intentionality and infrastructure of a municipal remote worker program is the real investment. More small and mid-sized towns should have similar networks in place, stipend or not. It sort of reminds me of the gold rush, Okabum said. There's a gold rush happening right now, except it's for quality of life. Places like Tulsa and all over the beautiful Mountain West, they're going to have a lot of people coming in search of a better quality of life. And it just makes sense to give people a way to acclimate to the city, to give them the resources and help guide and shape the change. Because they're coming. Like it or not, they're coming. We've thought a lot about this in our own role, moving to Missoula, Montana, back in 2017 to work remotely. As the participants in Tulsa Remote have shown, there's no simple checklist to become a conscientious member of the community, and no carbon-neutralizing payment you can make and forget about. Buying local and tipping well? That's great. So is taking the bus a few times a week. But when it comes to larger solutions, they're kind of like personal recycling. Individual choices that make us feel good, but can also let us off the hook for the much larger task of grappling with collective problems. Even if you can now afford your dream house, a city where housing is unaffordable for most is a broken city. Even if you can afford to buy and use your own car, a city where transportation is difficult for many is a broken city. Even if you have a backyard, a city where green space is unsafe, underfunded, and inaccessible is a broken city. The effects of a broken or breaking city are most immediately felt by those who are the most vulnerable, but they ripple into the lives of everyone who lives there and in the surrounding area. So many of the institutions that make up our cities were breaking or long broken pre-COVID, but the decisions we make moving forward have the potential to aggravate pre-existing problems, or, if we think expansively and collectively, can begin to fix them. That work requires the political, financial, and on-the-ground support of people with the social capital to effect change. If you are listening to this book because you're confident a remote future can work, then this means you. Whether you're in the city, in the suburbs, or in a rural area, whether you've recently moved or have pledged yourself to the long haul where you are, there are ways for you to support the infrastructure of your immediate and extended area. First and foremost, that means getting on board with paying for civilization, better known as taxes. But it also means articulating support and helping to sway public opinion about the need for infrastructure, even if, especially if, you are not its primary beneficiary. Look at your community and ask yourself, what do you, as a relatively privileged knowledge worker, like about living there? Maybe it's the schools, the ease of getting from one place to another, the public bathrooms at the playground, or the great local library. Now, how can you work to extend those benefits to people who don't work in the same sort of job as you do? The answer is pretty simple. Pay for the robust maintenance of public institutions. For example, maybe you or your company can afford dues at a local co-working space. So how do you support the creation of more public, affordable, or subsidized work areas for others? Maybe you live in a neighborhood within walking distance of a park or trail. How can you work to elect local leaders and support initiatives that make the sort of access a priority in every zip code? Maybe you're making an income that makes it easy to pay your rent or mortgage where you live, but the people who make up the beating heart of your community can't find anything in their price range. How can you demand affordable housing, even if that housing will be in your neighborhood? You can fine-tune your at-home workstation, and your company can figure out the most inviting setup for collaborative work in the office. But the whole point of all this flexible work is to cultivate a life outside our offices, untethered from our laptops. Unless we continue to invest in the world outside those spaces, what is any of this ultimately for? Reimagine childcare. Long before the pandemic, the problem with childcare in the United States has fundamentally been a problem of individualism. There was a brief opportunity back in 1971 to head off this fate. The Comprehensive Child Development Act of 1971 had made its way through Congress with overwhelming bipartisan support. Building on the success of Head Start, which had launched in 1965, the Child Development Act would have made high-quality childcare available on an affordable sliding scale basis for all. But Nixon vetoed the bill, a move that, as Anna K. Danziger-Halperin, a historian of the childcare movement, explains, surprised even officials within his own administration. The reasoning, according to Danziger-Halperin, was fear from the right wing of the Republican Party that the CDA would encourage women to join the workforce, thereby destroying the integrity of the middle-class family unit, while also providing solutions that felt dangerously close to communistic, un-American care. There was also conservative concern that the bill was an overreach into the lives of the poor and that its primary beneficiaries were families of color. As Professor Elizabeth Pally, who also studies the history of child care, explained it, white people don't want to pay for black people's children to be cared for. Nixon's veto and the accompanying legacy of child care as the responsibility of individual families, subject to the whims of the free market, have stuck. The coalition behind the bill dispersed, and feminist focus, particularly over the course of the late 1970s and the 1980s, was more on getting women into jobs in the first place and protecting them from discrimination once there. They stopped fighting for child care and the other sorts of collective issues and really focused on the individual professional success, Danziger Halpern told us. But when you think of child care as a personal choice, it creates all of these new inequalities. Women of color, black and immigrant women, they end up caring for the children of professional women. And those professional women, in turn, don't want their whole paycheck going to child care. So it gets undervalued and underpaid. That's how you get our current hodgepodge of a system, filled with wait lists for care centers, nanny shares, kith and kin, aka close friends and family care, unpredictable subsidies tied to working hours, low wages for caregivers, and astronomical cost burdens for parents. Middle-class workers may have more access to quality care, but that care comes at a great destabilizing cost, which will only rise in the post-pandemic landscape. This has been a problem for years, but the pandemic has underlined just how unsustainable the system has become. Part of the problem is that child care crosses so many different policy areas. Should it be considered first and foremost an anti-poverty program? An educational program? A program for mothers, for workers, for families, or for children? Solutions have been fragmented and, as evidenced by the current difficulty in finding affordable, high-quality care, completely insufficient. So here are your options. As your work schedule becomes more flexible, you can use it as an opportunity to bend yourself around your children's care schedule and keep paying as much as, if not more than before. You can keep dreaming of a scenario like the one available to workers at Patagonia's headquarters and distribution center, where childcare is on-site, multilingual, and subsidized, while you keep trying to cobble together nanny shares and stay awake at night thinking about how long you can rely on your mother-in-law to cover Fridays. Or you can use this opportunity to advocate for a real paradigm shift in the way we think of care. Utah Senator Mitt Romney's 2021 proposal to offer significant subsidies to families with children, $4,200 a year per child under 6, and $3,000 per child aged 6 to 17, acknowledges the extent of the problem. But it's still an individualistic solution that does little to actually address the dearth of affordable quality care options. As Elliot Haspel, the author of Crawling Behind, America's Child Care Crisis and How to Fix It, put it to us, I don't think a child care subsidy of even $10,000 a year is enough to bring us out of this nosedive. What we need are solutions like what nearly happened back in 1971, and what's successfully taken hold in the United Kingdom and so many other countries. We have to start thinking of early child care and education the same way we think about public parks or sanitation or libraries or public schools, as foundational to a functioning society, whether or not you directly benefit from its existence. We've been so stuck on this idea that there should be sliding scales, eligibility qualifications, or tied to work, Haspel explained. It's been so, so destructive. We have to move away from seeing child care as an entitlement and towards seeing it as a public good. This scenario is only possible, of course, when and if early child care is robustly funded, just as public schools are, with tax dollars. That sounds like a straightforward solution, and in some ways it is. In other ways, it's endlessly complicated. The conversations that most people have about childcare usually start with the astronomical cost, touch on the difficulty of waiting lists, glance toward the difficulty of finding a good fit, often code for perceived quality, and then stop. Families somehow figure out a way to make it work, even if that means someone dropping out of the workforce, relying on informal kith and kin care, or emptying out savings, and then everyone breathes a deep sigh of relief when the youngest kid hits kindergarten. The struggle to pay for care is acute, but ultimately too short-lived to accumulate political might. That can change. Regardless of whether you have children, whether you have three in care, or yours have already left the home, we can identify the burden and the way it exacerbates racial inequities, sustains the gender pay gap, discourages parenthood, and just generally makes life really, really hard for millions of people, and agree that it doesn't have to be this way. The easiest way for that to happen? Some people think it has to happen on the federal level, others on the level of the state. Biden has put forth a plan that envisions free pre-K for 3- and 4-year-olds, but as Nicole Rogers, founder of Family Story, explains, the problem with childcare policy is that it never, ever is first. She fears that childcare reform is going to be that thing of, it would be nice to do this, but we're not going to do this right now. You have the opportunity to refuse that equivocation. Yes, these programs will cost money, but the point of this sort of spending is that the burden on your everyday life will go down. This is especially true if you're a parent. But if you work at an organization and have seen firsthand the burdens of unpredictable care on your coworkers, you could also understand just how revelatory it could be. Otherwise, we queue up a nightmare scenario. Childcare becomes even more of a precious luxury good than it already is, accessible only to the upper middle class and the truly affluent. We already see women being shoved out of the workplace in droves to provide this care, Haspel said. So we can revert back to that situation where mothers are expected to bear the brunt of care in the home and the cascading effects on family income and stability. And this, of course, will ultimately have effects on people and their decision whether or not to bear children, and we're already at historically low birth rates. All of it's regressive, all the way down. But there are examples, even just in the United States, of what we could do. Proposed Common Start legislation in Massachusetts would fully fund childcare and after-school care across the state, with anyone earning half the state's median income qualifying for free care, while those earning more would pay on a sliding scale, maxing out at no more than 7% of their household income. In Vermont, H-171, which at the time of this writing was speeding through the state legislature with around 2/3 of the House of Representatives signed on as co-sponsors, promises to fundamentally remake the child care system in the state. No family would be asked to pay more than 10% of their income on care, and the 17.2% pay gap between early childhood educators and elementary school teachers would be closed entirely, significantly decreasing the 10.9% of Vermont's ECE workforce who lived in poverty. In 2020, a ballot initiative for universal preschool won 64% of the vote in Portland, Oregon, and surrounding Multnomah County. In addition to providing free care for 3- and 4-year-olds, regardless of family income, the initiative raises preschool teacher salary from $31,000 a year to $74,000 a year, with the aim of making the profession more attractive and sustainable. And they're doing it by taxing the upper echelons of the income bracket. 1.5% on single incomes of more than $125,000 and joint filings of more than $200,000. Two of these models require electing politicians on the state level who support this sort of change. The other required votes on the municipal level. In each, you, as a voter and or taxpayer, have the ability to support this paradigm shift. It may or may not directly affect you, but could have dramatic life-altering effects on the overall well-being of your city and state and nation. And a diverse coalition of support, in every sense of the word, is absolutely fundamental to these initiatives' success. This can't just be about your child care costs, or your sisters, or your friends. We should support these changes because we don't want work and parenting, no matter your occupation, to feel so impossible, or like an impossible burden that's the individual's alone to bear. We focus so much on the child and on school readiness and making sure that kid develops well and is stable and secure, Haspel told us. And all that's so important, but we also have to think about what it takes for parents to actually thrive. Think what a weight it would lift off you, off parents in different jobs from you, off your neighbors and people across your town, to have the weight of finding affordable, high-quality childcare for their 3- and 4-year-olds, regardless of their employment status, lifted from them. This isn't fantasy. It's very real, and in very real practice in countries that aren't the United States. You can give yourself and others in your greater community that gift, even if you will not or no longer be its primary beneficiary. You just need to refuse to shut up about it until it happens. Worker solidarity. Writing about the white-collar office worker in 1951, the sociologist C. Wright Mills declared that whatever common interests they have do not lead to unity. That was true then, and it's true now. Office workers have either resisted or given up on efforts to generate solidarity, especially when formalized in a union. As Nikhil Saval put it in Cubed, white-collar workers believed ardently in the American dream of relentless upward mobility. They preferred an insecurity of getting promoted based on merit to the steady advance of seniority. Unions promised one thing above all, dignity, which white-collar workers claimed they already had, thanks to the prestige of their professions, the bleached stiffness of their collars. In short, unions were for people stuck on a certain rung of the American dream, or who couldn't advocate for themselves. For those who'd made it to the office, unions just weren't necessary. Corporations have actively cultivated this attitude for decades. The entire field of human resources is meant to convince workers that the company has their best interests at heart. Even the good management that we've extolled in previous chapters can undercut solidarity, because hope for advancement and tiny shifts in job title and salary keep employees invested in their individual potential instead of collective protections. Internal comms, whether in the form of all-company emails, Slack channels, or all-hands, highlight and celebrate achievements within an organization, but also model the way employees should behave, underlining the proper posture toward work and the company as a whole. As the professor of management, Joanne Gates, argues in Control Through Communication, these types of messaging have long been used to encourage feelings of family and attendant loyalty among workers. And you don't form a union with your fellow siblings when you get angry at your parents. That's just disrespectful. Or at least that's been the enduring and largely successful messaging toward office workers. There have been pockets of organizational success, particularly government employees. But private corporations have become experts at keeping organizing efforts at bay. It's not that office workers are necessarily anti-union. They just don't think they need the protections a union can offer or are too worried about the potential backlash. But that sentiment has begun to lift. Back in the 1950s, Mills predicted a potential future for the white-collar profession. A large percentage would become proletarianized, which is to say their wages, overall income, prestige, power, and stability would come to resemble that of the wage worker. It would be possible, Mills wrote, for a segment of the white-collar people to become virtually identical with wage workers in income, property, and skill, but to resist being like them in prestige claims and anchor to their whole consciousness upon illusory prestige factors. You might have watched this happen in your own organization, or left a profession or company because it did. Or you might be watching it gradually happen in your own office, as your company opts to fill more positions with subcontractors who might be doing very similar work, but for less pay, with far fewer benefits, or with less security. In some organizations, the ongoing precarity has led workers to embrace organizing efforts for the first time. Workers in digital media, in museums, at Google and Amazon, in breweries and coffee shops, and in cannabis production, are unionizing, or attempting to, for the first time. Some of these workers, particularly those outside office environments, are fighting for very simple protections. Severance after layoffs, safety protections during COVID, work schedules available with enough time to schedule childcare and paid sick leave. And some just increasingly recognize themselves as part of the precariat, the term the theorist Guy Standing uses to describe a class of worker who feels fundamentally unstable in their work, regardless of education or vocation. Maybe you don't feel this in your job. Maybe you do feel cared for. Maybe your company is great and authentically trying to be better, and your boss is understanding. That is great for you. But a good boss is not a good system. It is a short-term individual solution. Which doesn't mean you need to say screw you to your company. It means figuring out how you can create scenarios in which the stability and flexibility extended to you doesn't hinge on happening to have a good, understanding boss. Put differently, it means cultivating cross-class, cross-profession solidarity. Back in the 1970s, it was incredibly difficult for any woman, regardless of her background, to rise above clerical work within an organization. As a result, the coalition that formed to advocate for better clerical protections cut across class, race, and educational background. As that coalition grew, corporations recognized its power, and, as Karen Nussbaum, the woman who helped organize clerical and office workers in the 1970s and 1980s, put it to us. Execs got sick of their own daughters complaining about their treatment at the office. They had to figure out some safety valve for the growing dissatisfaction, some way to decrease the pressure before a wave of organizing really took hold. The answer was simple. They started promoting the educated, middle-class woman out of the secretarial pool. They were so clever about splitting the workforce, Nussbaum said. If you were an individual woman who had been working at an insurance company, say, and all of a sudden they finally promoted you, you thought, well, good, this is what we've been fighting for. The problem was that it was only good for part of the coalition, but once it had been divided, its power was lost. There was this powerful moment in the 1970s and early 80s when women were having independent lives, when a lot of us were able to become very self-reliant, but we were pretty powerless at the same time, Nussbaum recalled. We felt pretty good about ourselves. We were divorcing bad husbands, raising our kids, working all the time, advocating for equality, but it wasn't all that great. A similar phenomenon is happening right now in many of the workplaces most eager to embrace remote work. In early 2021, more than 400 Google employees formed the Alphabet Workers Union, a historic years-long effort to elevate worker concerns that go well beyond pay inequity to address issues from algorithmic bias to ethical concerns about government contracts. But Google, like so many companies in Silicon Valley, offers an updated version of the white-collar union aversion that Mills described in 1951. Tech companies are home to some of the most desirable jobs available for the American worker, with the highest starting salaries and seemingly limitless on-site perks. At the same time, many of these companies rely heavily on a temporary and contract labor force, so much so that at Google there are more contract employees than full-time employees. There are few formal protections in place preventing Google from gradually transitioning more and more of its workers to contingent status. So why don't employees unionize? Many just don't think they need it. After all, they have some of the best jobs on the planet. But that sort of thinking has its limitations, especially as the feasibility of remote work leads companies to outsource developer jobs to whoever's willing to work for less. A big draw of remote work is being able to expand the pool of hiring talent, Natalia Nedzvitskaya, a researcher at the University of California, Berkeley, who studies the organization efforts of tech companies, told us. But this has the potential to intersect with the global labor market in a way that allows these companies to undermine their current workers, especially those who might be trying to build collective action in the industry. Given the opportunity to decrease labor costs by 60% by hiring in the Global South, I guarantee they're going to look into it very seriously. Nedzvitskaya is also concerned that remote work could make some parts of organizing more difficult. The physical space is helpful, she said. Being physically present helps you see who is with you and who shares your values, and who will take the same stand as you, which can be crucial because organizing in the workplace is still so risky in the United States. Still, she argues, there are templates for remote organizing in the tech space that have helped build solidarity. In 2018, more than 20,000 employees staged a walkout to protest how Google handled sexual harassment, which was organized largely online. Nedzvitskaya also cited the phenomenon of the open letter, now blog post, which tech employees have used to gain media attention to their demands. But those demands might only go so far without the ability to gather and build trust in person. A collective sense of outrage may get the ball rolling, in other words, but it's still fundamentally different from joining together to spell out workers' rights or put mechanisms in place to hold management accountable. Formal organization is needed to bring about lasting change, Nedzvitskaya says, and remote workers will need to be very intentional to create that. The reality, no matter where you work and for what level of pay, is that our overall system of labor protections is broken. If you've managed to avoid some form of exploitation, it's almost certainly because you've had enough financial security to quit jobs when they start to tilt that way, or avoid them altogether. But when the system is broken, it doesn't matter how self-reliant you are. It'll still break you too, if you step off the wheel of work. Which means that regardless of your current feeling of stability, we have to keep advocating for programs like universal healthcare, which separate safety nets from place or type of employment. But we also have to think more about what broad forms of worker solidarity look like, in and outside the office. Because unions, at least in our current moment, simply aren't available to everyone. to advise as if they were is unrealistic. But that doesn't mean you can't start thinking about unions or supporting people who are unionizing, including those who work in different sectors of your company. And it means electing leaders who are committed to strengthening our diluted labor protections, which have failed to take the radical changes of the last 40 years of the labor market into account. So ask yourself this. How would your office culture shift if you actually thought of yourself not as a copywriter or a claims adjuster or software developer, but as a worker? How can you focus on what binds you to the other workers in your life, in and outside your own company, instead of what differentiates you? Otherwise, we're just like the women who, perhaps understandably, took the promotions offered to them in the 1970s and 80s, leaving the remaining secretarial workers' efforts behind. We've spent time trying to give you the strategies to rethink our particular type of laptop-bound work. But moving forward, we also have to figure out how to simultaneously advocate for those whose work does not resemble ours, but is in no way less essential to a functioning society. We can rethink the theory of individual advancement that we've bought for all these years that's brought us to this place where capitalism has no combatants, nothing to keep it in check, Nussbaum told us. You just need to have a constellation of forces, people who are fed up, the collapse of institutions, a rupture in the way people work. You just need a moment, in other words, like right now. Reestablish networks of care and community. Pre-pandemic, we carved hours of time out of our weeks to be with other people in some way, supervising kids' practice, in meetings and classes, at playdates, at concerts and performances, at anniversaries and bachelorette weekends and birthday parties, at destination conferences and reunions. We did, indeed, gather together. But many of us secretly found these experiences underwhelming, even if we'd never admit it. We spent much of that time in uninspiring, underwhelming moments that fail to capture us, change us in any way, or connect us to one another, Priya Parker writes in The Art of Gathering. Much of the time we spend in gatherings with other people disappoints us. Parker argues that we've lost what's actually meaningful about gatherings, the crackle and flourish that allows them to bond people to one another and create networks of care. Pre-pandemic, people had become so fixated on the logistics of gathering that they lost sight of why we gather in the first place. Our calendars went from a private analog to digital and semi-public, and in the process, an overbooked life became a status symbol. We'd forgotten, in other words, what being with other people is actually for. So what is it for? Fun, of course, and diversion, but also genuine care. The sort that stems from reestablishing the kinds of strong and loose ties that distinguished the more collectivist moments of our not-so-distant past. Cultivating those ties doesn't mean you necessarily need to start going to religious services or navigating the naughty politics of your kid's elementary school PTA. It doesn't mean signing up for 5 different mailing lists in the hope of finally getting the gumption to show up for a meeting or finding another book club of friends of a friend whom you secretly resent. It means finding a network that actually means something to you, and figuring out what it might look like for you to care for, and to be cared for in return by others within it. Mutual aid was the bedrock of so many of the organizations listed in the beginning of this chapter, and it formalized the promise of support and insurance that members could not find outside their own networks. Over the last century and a half, mutual aid has provided a means to build safety nets for one another. As immigrants, as Black Americans, as trans people, when the state and established capital either refused or failed. Which is part of why mutual aid in so many forms has flourished over the course of the pandemic. When it became clear that the state was failing to protect the vulnerable, people did what many had forgotten was, in fact, second nature. They cared for each other. All over the world, but especially in the United States, where societal support was hard to come by, groups that had been formed for different functions, Buy Nothing Facebook groups, political organizing, transformed their focus, while others were built from the ground up. Some had more radical and explicit anti-capitalist politics. Others, particularly in more conservative areas, centered on meeting requests from those in need. What distinguishes these groups from traditional charity organizations is their dedication to the mutual. As Mira Fickling, one of the leaders of Rocky Mountain Mutual Aid Network, explains, we don't means test, and we wouldn't even have the resources to means test even if we wanted to. If you say you need help, then you need help. People aren't clients. They are simply people who need help at a specific time. And of course, we hope this goes two ways. People who request help come and volunteer, and people who can provide help might, at some point, need it as well. That idea is at the heart of community fridge programs that have popped up across the country. There's always a flow of people stocking, servicing, and taking from the fridge. People who fill it with items from a recent shopping trip might, the next day, come and get something they need for themselves. They're just part of the larger fridge community. Mutual aid takes time. The sort of time that might actually be open to you if the rigidity of your schedule eases, alongside your addiction to work. It's a way to conceive of yourself as someone who doesn't simply give money to organizations, but is an active component of an organization yourself. It's also a significant act of necessary humility. A fundamental precept of mutual aid is that everyone needs aid at one time or another. To depend uniquely on yourself, or what at this point remains a broken state and federal government, is to declare yourself immune. Maybe because of your age or relative health or financial situation, you don't think you need other people now. But you will. You will fall ill. Your body and mind will, at some point, break down. You will temporarily or permanently lose an income stream. You will need advice, or an extra set of hands, or a person willing to unload a new table from your car, or a teaspoon of turmeric. And others will need a different set of advice, a different set of hands, and you to help them unload the table from their car, and a teaspoon of turmeric. What joy, what balance it can foster to give and receive in return. For so many, participation in these groups is an act of resistance, an enduring proof that our systems are broken and must be replaced. But even in protest, the experience can be a spiritual balm. In the uncertain early days of March 2020, we profiled a group of young community organizers outside Boston who, in under a week, created a massive digital mutual aid network to funnel money, deliveries, and crucial information to residents. The entire process was documented online, and delving into their spreadsheets, you could watch the bonds of community being formed, an uplifting, real-time document of people helping people. The organization offered not just logistical and financial aid, but also hope. Those loose and firm bonds of support can come from something like mutual aid, but they can come from other gatherings too, organized around a religion, a common community cause, or just proximity. They don't need to have secret handshakes, like many of the groups of the past, and we'd actually suggest avoiding any group where all members are the same age, race, vocation, or economic bracket as you. One of the things you'll miss about the office is talking with people who are younger and older than you, and forming cross-generational bonds. But the opportunity for those connections doesn't have to disappear simply because you're no longer commuting. You might be struggling to figure out what that means for you. You might be on a lot of email lists and get a lot of text alerts, but feel as if you'd never be the sort of person who'd show up for a meeting. You might still feel that committing to anything, truly anything, is more than you're able to offer right now. Give it time while you figure out the new rhythms of your life, but not too much. Because part of what will motivate you to advocate for and maintain a flexible schedule is realizing just how much more time you have for these sorts of connections, particularly when you're able to stop thinking of them as obstacles to rest and start thinking of them as conduits to care. Try to imagine what might make you feel authentically connected. Maybe it's singing with other people. Maybe it's talking over the course of hours on a trail or learning a new skill. Or teaching one to others. It might include some component of ritual that makes the time feel meaningful, or a lot of small talk with people with long, meandering memories. What matters is not limiting yourself to your ideas of what gathering, especially the sort of gathering that you've resented pre-pandemic, looks like. Did your book club suck? Leave it and start volunteering with your local library. Did your community's next door page devolve into toxicity? Screw it. Go leave a note with your number in the mailbox of the 80-something-year-old down the street. Do you love card games but would never have anyone to play with? There's a bridge club that would love to have you. We promise. Does church feel traumatizing but you miss hymns and being with a random assortment of people who aren't like you? There's another version of that. It just might take some seeking. Partway through the pandemic, Devin, who recently finished his PhD in geology and lives in Atlanta, was desperate for a way to connect to and help his community, to the point that he was considering applying to med school. But then he found out about Concrete Jungle, a small urban farm in southwest Atlanta. "I get to do farming work that I really enjoy and found soothing," he said. "And I also know that what we produce is going directly to people who need and are deeply deserving of healthy, fresh food. I've personally picked veggies and then packed those veggies up and delivered them to the door of someone who wouldn't be able to access them any other way." For Devin, the opportunity for direct aid filled a void in his paid work. And, he says, "getting involved in this community has really opened my eyes to how hard a lot of people are working to make Georgia a better place, which is inspiring, to say the least." Jackie started volunteering with DC Books to Prisons, which sends books to incarcerated readers in 34 states. In 2019 alone, the organization sent more than 7,000 packages. Before the pandemic, they'd meet in a church to coordinate requests, but they were able to shift the work to home. From time to time, she has to look up someone before she sends them a package to double-check their name and current facility. "That means I often see what they're in prison for and find out they are convicted pedophiles, rapists, and murderers. And I still carefully pick out books that I hope they like," she said. "That is a new experience that has made my empathy grow beyond what it once was. It also," she says, "made her a better reader. We get a huge number of requests for Westerns, so I read Lonesome Dove to be more familiar with the genre. What a story. And I would have never checked it out without the people writing us. What a gift." Cultivating a community of care might also look like reinvesting in connections that have gone fallow, for whatever reason, with time. "We don't have children, but we've long wanted to be a part of the children's lives in our greater friend circle. Before the pandemic, our dedication to work made it difficult to establish any sort of consistent presence in our friends' kids' lives. But the pod we created with another family has allowed us to prioritize these relationships like never before. And spending time with their children is deeply enriching for all parties. Rolling on the floor and playing zombie hide-and-seek and drawing underwater creatures have been welcome, cherished distractions from the seriousness of our adult lives, and helped ease our friends' care burden. Others have told us similar stories, of moving home or to the area where their closest friends live, or even figuring out co-living scenarios with another family. You could blame those moves on the pandemic, or you could just view the pandemic as a catalyst for actually seeking out the intimacy and care we crave. But you need to cultivate patience, too. We're so used to on-demand everything, we've forgotten that community takes time to find, to join, to figure out one's place, to guide. Community is wonderful, but it's also awful," Casper Cattile, author of The Power of Ritual, told us. "People are hard, but we need these structures to hold us together, even when it's hard. Because if we engage with our community and spiritual lives as consumers, and we check out when it isn't immediately satisfying, we end up losing the most precious experiences of life. There are opportunities to create, nurture, and grow these sorts of gatherings wherever you are, but you need to have the wherewithal to find and commit to them. And that wherewithal is incredibly difficult to come by when work remains the axis of your life. But we've mired ourselves in a circular logic. We live to work because there's so little else in our lives. There's so little else in our lives because we live to work. But it doesn't have to be this way. Consider Obum Ukabum from Tulsa. After spending a decade feeling overextended and rootless, he found that a few intentional changes to his work and living scenario completely changed the context and purpose of his life. But Ukabum's path toward community is just one way forward. Depending on your personality, you could be the catalyst, the behind-the-scenes support, the person who shows up every week to do cleanup. Your role matters much less than the slow-motion revelation of shared commitment to each other. This is what networks of care, like all forms of collectivism, do. They weave us into reliance on each other. Instead of ignoring suffering, we are encouraged to address it head on. Such networks have the potential to cultivate our best and most generous selves and counteract the turn toward individualism, but only if we continue to seek out groups and initiatives that both challenge and comfort us, that benefit us, but even more important, benefit those whose situations are nothing like our own. All the potential solutions and pitfalls mentioned underscore a crucial reality. Flexible work is not, in itself, the cure to all that ails our society. but it does open the door to continue the essential work of addressing our bigger problems head on. Additional time and space and energy make it possible to be far more intentional about how we live in our communities. When we're not constantly triaging our own lives, we can begin to care for others. But as we've attempted to outline throughout this book, the true benefits of remote work will only arrive if we codify them with real policy, the sort that makes them tenable beyond the world of knowledge work. To put it bluntly, to gain these freedoms for ourselves and call it good will be nothing less than a collective moral failure. We get it. We're all tired. And we know that the resistance to this sort of reform and this ethos of care is robust. But societal safety nets aren't actually reliable, no matter how much you make today or how safe you feel in your current position, until they're built strong enough to catch us all, no matter how hard, where, or why we fall. We have made ourselves so unspeakably alone for so long, so desperate in our self-reliance. But there's a very different way forward, visible once the haze of overwork has cleared. It's through and with each other.